Everybody's here. Everybody's here. If you're not here, let me know. How is everybody tonight? Does anybody need anything? The facilities are working out. Nothing needs to be addressed. So, sometimes change in understanding can be difficult. And I'm only bringing that up now because we've covered an awful lot of ground and we're getting to the heart of the matter. And so those of you that listen to me or come to the class, you always hear me say, be very gentle with yourself. This is when it's most important. When stuff starts coming up, it doesn't mean you're doing something wrong. It means you're starting to feel something. For many of us, for the first time, it's okay, but it can also be very difficult. There's a very good saying that's apropos. It's good to have an open mind, but not so open that your brains fall out. If you start feeling like your brains are falling out, slow down a little bit. It's okay to even step back from consideration of what you've learned. Develop your own type of balance. Take a breath. If things seem to be getting a little bit more difficult, if you don't think you can handle it, give me a call. Or give Matt a call, or Maura a call, or call each other. It's okay to ask for support as we go through this. The monks and later on the nuns, as they developed awakening and they faced all of their hardened views, they had each other. They had an ongoing sangha. That's why one of the reasons why the Buddha said the most important part of the Dhamma is the sangha. We need each other. And we've had an incredible ongoing experience of a quick formation of a sangha. You know, some of us have been together in Frenchtown, but we've come together this weekend in incredible support. From this seat, it's just amazing. When you leave here, you haven't lost the support. Again, we have each other. You have the Dhamma. When things come up, understand that it's just impermanence that's coming up. It's nothing really all that important, but sometimes it can feel overwhelming, you know, so we need each other. So again, I'm just trying to make the point, if you need somebody to hold your hand for a while, it's okay. There's nothing wrong with it. You're not doing something wrong. The Dhamma is working as it should. It's bringing stuff up so we can clear it out. That's all, you know. Always be gentle with yourself. So we're now about a month after the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. And in that month, the Sangha has grown from 5 bhikkhus to about 1,000. And some other questions have arisen. How is it that this stuff forms in the first place? What is the actual thing that we're doing? Now people are getting a handle on this Anatta stuff. But so what's causing this? And the Buddhist then brings this discourse back to, remember we were talking about eye consciousness, ear consciousness. Our senses have their own type of consciousness, their own interpretive way of seeing things. Now the Buddha's going to bring that even into a more deeper but well-focused vision. So we can see how we're doing this exactly. That's what the fire discourse is about. And what he's really describing, so in a general way you could say the Four Noble Truths are speaking about impermanence. In a general way, that's the first mark of existence in Nietzsche. The Anatta Lakkhana Sutta is about anatta, the second mark of existence. And now the Buddha is bringing in, he's kind of closing in that circle. Remember the board too, that board right there. Selfing, impermanence, dukkha. Selfing, impermanence, liberation. You know, that's that impermanence is the point that this process revolves around. The Buddha presented his first two discourses to the ascetics he had previously befriended. The first discourse on the Four Noble Truths explained the cause of delusion in the world and the path to understanding. The second discourse explained how the perception of individuality arises and what forms the belief in self. About a month after the Buddha's first two discourses, he presented the fire discourse to approximately 1,000 followers. Upon hearing this short discourse, most of those in attendance awakened. At that time in northern India and Nepal, there were various cults who engaged in ritualistic worship, sacrifice, and mystical practices. One of these cults was a popular fire cult devoted to rituals using fire. The Buddha used the fire worshippers as an analogy to how individual personalities worship what contacts the senses. The fire discourse presented is a brief but insightful look at how the physical senses interpreted by the intellect reinforce the belief in self. So he's really getting into the heart of the five clinging aggregates. What's this process that keeps reinforcing this belief, this false belief in an ongoing permanent self? The Adita Pariya Sutta. The Buddha was staying at Gaya Head with 1,000 monks. Again, this is all a slightly different town, but all in that same area that the Buddha first awakened. He hasn't really started traveling yet. The Buddha addressed the 1,000 monks in attendance. Monks, the all is a flame. So he's saying everything is a flame. Your whole existence right now is a flame. What all is a flame? The eye is a flame. Forms are a flame. Consciousness at the eye is a flame. Contact at the eye is a flame. He's again referring back to the fire cult. Because of your reaction to what's coming through your senses, you're on fire. And think about that. You're on fire. One thing to kind of introduce here, the word for that's described the awakened state is nibbana. Sanskrit is nirvana. What that means is extinguished, and it relates directly to the sutta. The flames of passion have been extinguished in an awakened human being. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the eye, experienced as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too is a flame. Now he's relating that back to dependent origination in a way that we could understand it, but they couldn't yet because they haven't been given that. But each one of those links keeps the fire going in dependent origination. A flame with what? A flame with the fire of passion, the fire of aversion, the fire of delusion. A flame, I tell you, with birth, aging, and death, with sorrows, lamentation, pains, distress, and despairs. It's a flame with dukkha. The Buddha's being very dramatic, isn't he? But he's making a very clear point. Dukkha will burn you. And it's ongoing. The ear is a flame. He's referring to an unawakened person who, as things come through their senses, it keeps this flame going because we don't have the proper reference points. We don't have right view yet. Sounds are a flame. The nose is a flame. Aromas are a flame. The tongue is a flame. Flavors are a flame. The body is a flame. Tactile sensations are a flame. The intellect is a flame. Your thinking process is contributing to this fire that's burning. Consciousness at the intellect is a flame. Contact at the intellect is a flame. And whatever there is that arises and dependent on contact at the intellect, experiences pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too is a flame. Man, we're in trouble. We are on fire. How are we going to put it out? A flame with what? A flame with the fires of passion, the fire of aversion, the fire of delusion, a flame, I say, with birth, aging, and death, with sorrows, lamentation, pains, distresses, and despairs. We're a flame with dukkha. Remember, dukkha occurs from what? From ignorance. Seeing thus, the well-instructed disciple of the noble one grows disenchanted with the eye. We realize the process that we've put in place, and we're growing disenchanted with that connection, with that clinging to passion, with that clinging, that need for constant sensory stimulation. We've now seen what it does, and we understand who it's happening to this thing that is impermanent. Seeing thus, the well-instructed disciple of the noble one goes disenchanted with the eye, disenchanted with forms, disenchanted with consciousness at the eye, meaning this ongoing deluded thinking. We no longer need to protect it. We're disenchanted. The word that we used this morning was estrangement. We're separating ourselves from this identity now. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the eye, experiences pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, with that too, we grow disenchanted. We grow disenchanted with the ear, disenchanted with the nose, disenchanted with the tongue, disenchanted with the body. They grow disenchanted with the intellect, disenchanted with ideas, disenchanted with consciousness at the intellect, disenchanted with contact at the intellect. In other words, disenchanted with the five clinging aggregates. We're finding out that we should not place so much importance on this thing that we call ourselves. We've seen what it can do. We've seen very clearly dukkha arising. And that's leading us to estrangement, to disenchantment. What is the opposite of disenchantment? I'm enchanted with myself. I'm enchanted with what I'm doing and what I'm connecting to. I'm enchanted with the things that I say are important. I'm enchanted with the things that I say are not important. And I'm also aflame by those things that I'm attached to. Again, a very dramatic example that the Buddha is using very early in his teaching. The most gentle human being that ever lived is not being very gentle here, is he? Because he knows the gravity of this and he understands who he's talking to. People seeking enlightenment, they're seeking understanding. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the intellect, experience as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, they go disenchanted with that too. Disenchanted, they become dispassionate. They're no longer passionate. They're no longer full of passion. Through dispassion, they're fully released. With full release, there is the knowledge. You understand, I'm fully released. I'm not clinging to anything. They discern that birth is ended, the holy life fulfilled, the task is done, there is nothing further for this world. And remember, it's not about a future physical birth. It's about we're no longer giving birth to something that is rooted in ignorance that will continue those flames of passion. The flames that we are instilling that are burning ourselves up. I'm being a little dramatic too, to make the point. That is what the Blessed One said. Gratified, the monks delighted at his words, and while this explanation was being given, the hearts and minds of the thousand monks, through no clinging, not being sustained, were fully released from fermentation and further effluence. The Buddha is teaching that through dependent origination, the components that make up the self are inflamed by the passions that arise from desire and aversion. This passion drives the worship or attachment of sensory fulfillment and reinforces suffering or dukkha. It is the preoccupation with dukkha that perpetuates delusion. The lesson to the thousand followers was how delusion and a wrong view of self arises and is maintained. The Buddha taught that reacting to phenomena, contacting the senses, creates an identity that is attached to those sensations. Eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness.
Can you say that again?
Of course. I'll go back to the beginning of that paragraph. It is the preoccupation with dukkha that perpetuates delusion. Preoccupation with it. We're distracted by this thing. We've now set this process in place where we're attached to those things that are causing dukkha, and that attachment is creating a distraction. It's such a distraction that we don't see the process anymore. Again, that's why the Buddha taught that path, so we could see this distraction that's arising in us. The lesson to the thousand followers was how delusion and a wrong view of self arises and is maintained. The Buddha taught that reacting to phenomena, contacting the senses, creates an identity that is attached to dependent origination, the components that make up the self, that are inflamed by the passions that arise from desire and aversion. I probably could have written that sentence in three parts instead of one, but is that clear? Just explaining this process that is ongoing, rooted in ignorance.
Can you read it again?
Yes, okay. It is the preoccupation with dukkha that perpetuates delusion. The lesson to the 1,000 followers was how delusion and a wrong view of self arises and is maintained. The Buddha taught... Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't go back to the original paragraph. Yes, I did. Sorry about that. The Buddha taught that reacting to phenomena, contacting the senses, creates an identity, and this is probably where I should have broken it, that is attached to... Let me say it this way. That is attached to those sensations. And the independent origination explains how the flame keeps getting lit through each link in that independent origination. I'm going to go forward a little bit now, too. Awakening occurs as understanding develops through the Eightfold Path. Through the Eightfold Path, understanding of the nature of reality arises, and disenchantment with the six senses develops. In other words, the Eightfold Path is in place, so we can see this process, and it gives us the framework and also the safety to stop lighting the flame. Is that clear? We were talking... I was talking to someone before about how, it might have been you, James, a little earlier today, that when we start engaging in the Eightfold Path, it gives us the comforting safety that we're protected within this path. We can make decisions and have and create right views that are no longer lead to suffering or no longer continue to light the flame. When we fall out of that path, we have a reaction. Some people it's fear, some people it's agitation, but it's always a reaction like that. And that reaction is there to show us that we're off the path. We're aflamed again. Is that clear? I want to go just a little bit further. The development of an ego self through the five clinging aggregates is maintained by discursive thinking, fueled by desire. Developing right view or right understanding brings renunciation. The strong attachments to the wrong view of self manifest as hindrances to practice. Doubt rooted in an identity of self and the constant need for sensory input are to be recognized and abandoned. So that's as far as I'm going to go tonight on the fire discourse. You've heard it. Do you see how it applies?
John.
Yes. Oh, I don't. I'm on the Kindle. So, I'm near the end of. I'm probably two or three pages past the end of the Fire Discourse.
Doubt rooted in an identity of self and the constant need for sensory input are to be recognized and abandoned. Doubt rooted in an identity of self manifests as an unwillingness to accept anything that would diminish or negate the image of self.
Do you have a comment on that? Or are you just trying to figure out what it means?
Read that one again.
That really helped when you read it to me really slow. You want me to read it to you really slow?
And you're describing this passage. Well, this isn't passage. This is what I wrote. Doubt rooted in an identity of self and the constant need for sensory input are to be recognized and abandoned.
So abandon the phenomenal experience of having those doubts, those thoughts, those questions, and then see what comes next. You know, and then that'll change because it's impermanent. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and it's
the doubt will evolve, or you'll let go of it, you'll abandon it, and willingly.
It relates to Epasiko, come and see for yourself. As you start developing the Dhamma and see the practical benefits of it, doubt will vanish. initially when you're still stuck in these fires of passion, there's great doubt because the ego self feels like it's being annihilated. This can't be right. I'm dying. Even that feeling that you're being annihilated is part of the fires of passion. And again, the Buddha teaches everything in a very practical way, even though he's using a powerful metaphor here, as fire. He's saying that the process that you're going through is possible to extinguish through right view, through seeing the thing, through seeing that process that's up on the board, through seeing it clearly, through understanding that you're lighting the flame yourself. It's not pain that's being inflicted on you. It's arising from your own, whatever you're doing. It's arising from your own rooted in views rooted in ignorance. Doubt rooted in an identity of self and the constant need for sensory input are to be recognized and abandoned.
So there's two separate things. Doubt rooted in an identity of self and the constant need for sensory input are to be recognized.
It's written that way because we use the distraction of sensory input to obscure what's going on, to obscure our own doubt, our own fears, etc. You know, you could really probably put any other word you want there for doubt. Any one of the five hindrances, restlessness you mentioned.
Okay, yeah, but I think that's where I just got stuck. You could substitute anything.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Any one of the five hindrances.
Stuck, you know?
Yep. And all that I'm pointing out there is that then we want more distraction. Or another way that occurs often on our mats is just this: I can't stand this boredom anymore. There's got to be something else to this. Boredom is simply the need for more stimulation. And if we're used to constant stimulation, constant sensory input, it's going to make meditation very difficult, especially at first, because it feels extremely boring. And we don't allow for boredom, do we? We don't allow for the lack of constant sensory stimulation. The fire discourse is saying just that. You do this to yourself. You've got to keep these flames going through passion, through desire, through craving and clinging. Relating it right back to that ninth factor of the 12-link chain of dependencies. Craving leads to clinging and maintaining. You know, that's where the flame is keeping going through each of those links. And the Buddha is teaching very clearly, probably more clearly than I'm doing tonight, how that happens, how it happens within us. Through things coming through our senses, through our eye consciousness, our nose consciousness, etc. And lighting the passion, lighting that fire of passion. That's how the process occurs. So notice he's not saying that we should blind ourselves or cut our ears off or anything like that, anything drastic. What he's saying is to recognize the process and become dispassionate with what's coming through our senses. Understand the process. It's an ongoing process. Is it clear?
Yeah. We're attaching identity to sensory information. And
yep.
Making it mine.
Yeah, we're saying that's me. It's me because I had this experience. And I created some identity over the experience. It's lit the fires of passion of me, of more selfing, of more I-making. And until we extinguish those fires, actually I would say until we start lowering the flame a little bit, we can't see it because the flame is all-encompassing. It's all we see. All we see is our passions. We're driven by our passions. That's what the Buddha is saying. So the Buddha first taught the Four Noble Truths, then he taught the vehicle that has this experience, and now he's saying this is what the vehicle's doing to keep it going. And that the deep-rooted views continue to drive the passion.
Right.
Yeah, that's exactly what he's saying. Mary, you were talking about having passion for your job. And then we talked about there's a difference between having that useful passion and then creating an identity by it. And so, using you as an example, your idea of your relationship between you and your job, when it has an identity, creates a passion that burns rather than a useful mindfulness of this is what you need to be doing for your job. It's that passion rooted in a self-identity that creates the difficulty and the tension and all the other things that might follow from having that identity. There was a gentleman at our Wednesday night class who has a very high-stress job, and that's exactly what he's saying. The job itself is important, but he's have such an identity caught up in that job that he's burning up from it. Again, just using the metaphor. And you can look at this gentleman, and you can see it. He literally is burning up from this need to fulfill not doing a good job, but to keep his identity going as being a good, well, I won't say what he is. And that's been your experience.
Pardon?
That's been your personal experience.
Right.
Yeah. And so, again, going back to that self-identity, when we have an identity of self that's attached to what's going, we're aflamed. We're burning up. We're burning up by, and we're burning up by the fuel that we keep putting on by constant sensory input that we're seeking. And it never ends. So we can forget about the fire analogy and think about something else. We just burn up our energy. One of the things that we discover as we start lessening eye-making, we simply have more energy because we're not putting the energy into protecting that ego self anymore. Again, very practical.
In that example of you're not given enough time, would the right view be that you recognize that you haven't been given enough time, and as opposed to being passionate about, I have to get this done in this time frame that I've been given, it's taking that step back, the hair, saying, this is not realistic.
Exactly.
So I can talk to my boss and say, this is not, I know this is not enough time for me to get this done.
Yeah.
So let's talk about how we could get it done.
And even if that doesn't lead to resolution in your mind. That's right. And if you have a strong identity,
I don't expect her to be different, and I only do what I can do.
Yeah, and just because someone says that you should do it doesn't mean that it can be done. It might be an impossible task. Moore's past jobs have been a good example of that. They asked, excuse me for talking about you a lot, day after day, they would ask Moore to do things that just could not be done. It wasn't, you could be superwoman, you still could not get these done. But when you have a strong identity of being the perfect employee and never doing anything wrong and never being noticed or whatever it might be, it beats you up, it burns you up. That's what the Buddha's talking about in the Fire Discourse. But what he's also pointing out is that we create impossible situations to live into. And the impossible situation that he's talking about is attempting to establish a permanent self where it can't be established. It's an impossible task. It burns you up.
So you turn the flame down, and what's next?
Eventually, you turn the flame down enough that it goes out. And then you live a life of lasting peace and happiness. You, again, using the common terminology of nirvana, the flames have been extinguished. You're no longer giving fuel to those fires of passion. And so I think what you're asking is, so what motivates me? Why do I go do anything if I don't have that passion for it anymore? You're motivated out of the Eightfold Path. And so in a practical way, awakening doesn't mean you never have to get up and go to work. It simply means you don't have to drag an ego identity with you to work. A self-referential ego identity gets caught up in the day's events. You do what you do. And whatever you might be called to do, whether it's a teacher or it's a landscaper or a brain surgeon, you do it with complete dispassionate mindfulness, which means you're much more effective at it. The Buddha taught a middle way. Yeah. Now, again, remember what the Buddha was teaching is not anything magical or mystical or how to achieve superhuman powers in the world. What he's teaching is how to bring to cessation the disappointing nature to life. And what causes the disappointing nature to life on the job is thinking I need to do more than I can do, or having an ego identity of being something more than is possible, or just having that view at I need to be the perfect employee, I need to be the perfect boss. We all create these identities. When we shed the identity, we can just go to work and do our job. And it's just a practical teaching. We don't need the motivation of a self-referential ego self to live in the world. We'll live much better. It's hard to imagine it, though, isn't it? You're having a difficult time with it. Because that's who you think you are. That's all that you're familiar with. And I'm not just talking about you. This is the common problem. What happens when I let go, when I turn the flame off? What's going to keep me going? Go back to the first one that did it. He didn't turn the flame off and sit under a tree for the next 45 years. With dispassion, he lived the most effective human life anybody ever lived, I think. And the people that he taught and that awakened, they didn't then go sit in, some of them did go sit in the cave, but most of them went around northern India and eventually around the world spreading this teaching. How to end passion and develop dispassion. How to turn the fires of passion out that are burning you up, just using this metaphor, and live lives of lasting peace and happiness. What do we want out of life? Why are we going to work? Ultimately, we're going to work to continue, hopefully, to develop a life of peace and happiness. But when we have an ego attached to it, work becomes much more difficult than it needs to be, or anything else in life. We're using that as an example right now. Our relationships with each other are much more difficult when we're dealing with life from anatta, that which is not a self.
Right, because I'm measuring myself based on my perception of my work or my job,
yeah,
my, whatever I'm doing in my day.
So what is the Buddha? How does this fit in with the Buddha's teaching? Now remember, put it back into the context of the Four Noble Truths. It's the only thing that the Buddha is really concerned about. He's not really too concerned about us becoming super employees or the best of anything in a phenomenal way, in a worldly way. What he's trying to teach us, and I think he succeeds, is how to develop lasting peace and happiness by bringing wisdom to where there was once ignorance. Dukkha occurs. Craving and clinging originates and perpetuates dukkha. There's a way out. The Eightfold Path is the way out. Where's dukkha in the equation? What is our part in it? It's wanting to establish a permanent ego self where it can't be established, in an ongoing experience of impermanence. It can't be done. And then we're living our lives from this image of ourselves, rather than what's occurring in this moment. The image that I formed a week ago, I'm carrying it with me to today's task. But today's task might be different than what that image was created for, so it no longer fits. It's no longer appropriate. But yet I have this view of myself. It's all that I have with me right now. and I have to try and make it work. Great agitation, great disappointment happens. And then we create something that might feel good or it might feel successful. But that's impermanent. And I have an attachment to that little bit of a success. I've now achieved something. And the next day the business goes under. Where are you? Because you've attached yourself to being that person, when that person is forced to end because there's no longer a reference for it in the world, you're lost. Rather than understanding the ongoing process, this is what's occurring right now. And then when what is occurring right now, you recognize that process. When what is occurring right now ends, you're simply in the process of what's becoming now. And the most important thing is not what you're becoming at work, it's what you're becoming in your mind. So jobs can come and go, and they do all the time. But what's most important is we take to the Dhamma and awaken.
But it's not a bad thing to love what you do.
It's one of the better things if you can generate that. And that doesn't mean that every task is going to, or every job is going to be the most fulfilling thing. But you can look at it from the right view. It might not be something that you thought you'd ever end up doing. But at some point in your life, you might be lucky to have a ditch to dig for $5, you know? And that's an impermanent task. It might be that you find yourself in a position like Maura finds herself in often, that it's really an impossible job to do completely. But yet Maura does an incredible job of being present for the people that are in front of her. And that's what, right? More, that's what brings you fulfillment. It's not at the end of the day that you did the perfect job, because it's a job that you can't be perfect at. In fact, now that I said that, you can't be perfect at anything, because there's no such thing as perfection. There's just an ongoing process. If we strive for perfection, that's not to say that we shouldn't do the best we can in anything we do. But when we have an image of what perfection is, and I need to be perfect, I remember another speech that I gave right after I sobered up. I says, talking about, it's related to, I'm so glad that I can feel today. A few months later, I gave this talk, and these words came out of my mouth. I couldn't believe they came out of my mouth. I said, I'm so glad that I don't have to be perfect in an imperfect world. And I stopped. I said, what am I talking about? But I was so, my whole life, and I think everybody thinks that you have to be, whatever we decide is perfect, you got to be that. And it is impossible. It's yeah, well, which I was. And in fact, I kind of like being at
perfect. You have this idea of perfection, but many of us are. And it's always condition dependent. It's this constant comparison thing that perfect. I'm better than this one, I'm not as bad as that one. They all can do it, and I can't. What's wrong with me? Oh, I can do it, they can't. What's wrong with them? It's just an exhausting.
It's exhausting thicket of views. All rooted in an ignorant view of what you are, what constitutes a self. So stripping away all of that, even the powerful metaphor of the fire discourse, what's the Buddha saying? Again, coming back to those three marks of existence. What you think you are is not a self worth defending, worth trying to continue to establish, because it's based on a wrong view of the three marks of existence. Develop right view, the most important thing. When you go to work tomorrow, bring that right view with you.
And can I add just one more thing? So I'm sure you guys all have this experience too, but I have become such a better employee since I left out of the view of what it
was. But, because I know a lot about your situation, not everybody would say that. But only because Maura operates in a way that is more from her heart and mind together rather than trying to fit into a system perfectly. She does things sometimes that are contrary to the system, but they happen to be the best thing for the person in front of her, meaning a patient. And that gets her... that's the real bottom line, and Maura's been called out on that. And maybe there needs to be a balance there too. Maybe you should be a little more concerned about the corporate structure. But what's most important is the person that's in front of you that has a need to be met. A person that forgot how to get up off a chair. Well, maybe it takes more than 8 minutes because Medicare says it's 8 minutes that you get to spend, and Maura spends 20. She gets herself in trouble that way. But she's being compassionate. She's being wise. She's not worried about being the perfect employee. And I know I'm putting maybe too much emphasis on Maura tonight. But she continually gets herself in trouble because of that. Because she's maybe even too extreme, not concerned about being the perfect employee, but being the perfect, not the perfect, being the most useful human being she can be to the person in front of her. And it's honestly, I'm not trying to make Maura seem like great or foolish in any way. It's amazing to see what she's done. She's taken hopeless people that said they were hopeless. Nobody's ever given me any hope. And she's given them 5 more months of useful life before they die. It's incredible. Because she's not caught up in being the most perfect employee. She's beyond that. She has other problems, but she's beyond that. I don't need to qualify that. She's just a good example of what we're talking about. She has such an incredible passion for her real job that the passion for being the greatest employee is burned out. It's gone. It doesn't matter to her anymore. Again, well, I'm sorry for putting you on. I know I'm making you uncomfortable. But that's the point. There's some things that are more important, but we also have a consideration too, don't we? I got a spouse and 3 kids and 2 dogs and a house that are dependent on me. So there has to be a balance there. We shouldn't go to the extreme of asceticism. Well, I'm going to be the perfect Buddhist in my mind, and I don't care if I lose my job. That's not a reasonable way to look at this either. Bring right mindfulness in. Bring right the right livelihood is the fifth factor of the Eightfold Path for a reason. When I first came across the Eightfold Path, it looks like we're now talking about jobs, but it's a good topic because we have a lot of ourselves caught up in our jobs, don't we? We create an identity about our jobs, about what we do. You're asked, you know, who are you? What do you do? And the first thing you say is, well, you know, I'm a carpenter, I'm a massage therapist, I'm this or that. What was I talking about? I lost my train of thought.
Right livelihood.
So thank you. The first time I came across, well, not the first time, I came across the Eightfold Path, and I understood right speech and I understood right action. And then I looked at right livelihood. I said, why is the Buddha including right livelihood here? Isn't that covered by right speech and right action? And then I looked a little further and saw where the Buddha was teaching this in relation to right livelihood. And the reason why he taught this is because he recognized that people that were otherwise engaged in right speech and right action, when it was time to put food on the table, would put that aside even a little bit. It's understandable, isn't it? But it's also hurtful to the whole economic system, but it's hurtful to yourself. You're compromising your own values. But that's not to say you shouldn't be concerned. We have responsibilities. We talked about that. What is about love and responsibility? So if you find that you're in a situation where you have to compromise yourself continually just to put food on the table, wisdom says it's time to find another job. You know, it's all that it means. And it doesn't mean that you need to keep maintaining this identity. It means to recognize what's going on in your life. Look at it clearly. Krishnamurti often said, look at the life you're living. But he meant that in the way that the Buddha means it. See it through the eyes of reality. See it through the eyes of the Four Noble Truths. Look at the lives you're living. Does it fit in with right speech, right action, and right livelihood? Again, going back to the compromises that Maura's had to make, they've been hurtful to her at times. She's lost jobs over that, right, Maura? And that's not to say we all have to lose our jobs. But at some point, there's a decision you have to make. Do I take care of, more as in healthcare, do I take care of this person and maybe lose my job? I think Maura has made the right decision over and over again. It's cost her, a few jobs, you know? And that's not to say we should have to lose our jobs, but sometimes we do.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a word that relates to the Eightfold Path, and it's to integrate the Eightfold Path. And what that means is to live with integrity. Sometimes we have hard choices to make in life if we're going to live within this framework, isn't it? It's a middle path, but sometimes it doesn't allow for us to make unskillful choices if we're going to walk the path. It's just the way it is. You know, it's just the way it is. If we're going to, so now we're getting into some of the moral and ethical, I didn't really think I was going to go here tonight, but it needs to be addressed, I guess. This is what we're talking about. If we're going to walk this path, there are sometimes very hard choices that we have to make. And they're choices that are framed by right speech, right action, and right livelihood in conjunction with right view, understanding that there is dukkha. So if the unskillful choice would be to lead to more long-term suffering for myself and others, then the right choice is clear, isn't it? And that's different for every individual. If you're running a guns and ammo shop in northern Alaska, you better do everything you can to keep that store open because people's lives depend on getting guns and ammo to live. Maybe I'm not clear. There's people that live in an area like that that need to hunt for their food or they're going to starve to death. They need to have that gun shop. But a gun shop on the corner of Times Square maybe is inappropriate, especially when you're selling guns to people that you know are going to be shooting other people. It's the same job. Integrity tells you what is the appropriate place to keep open and what's the appropriate one to shut down. Right? Am I using a good description of this? And that can be true in any situation. Going into healthcare, you could be working for the most advanced and compassionate facility that there is. You could go to work for another place that is only concerned about the bottom line and makes compromises with people's lives. It's time to quit that job and try to go back to the other one. That's right livelihood. The same job. As somebody who is in a construction business, we all know that there's a lot of shady people in the construction business, but I can tell you, that's about 10% of the people. There was a time in my life, most of my life, I worked for myself, but I got this great offer of a job in Vermont, and I took it because it was a whole lot of money, and I thought it was going to be a lot of fun. About 3 weeks into the job, I realized that this guy was just abusing people. He was running tenements. He was keeping places going through fear and intimidation, and I was supposed to be one of them that did this. Obviously, I couldn't do it. The money was incredible, and for about a half a second, I thought, I really want this job. But I only wanted it for the money. And I felt awful from the first day I got there. I left the job and I did exactly the same job, but I was able to do it with integrity. And I felt good about myself again. You know, I'm using an example. I'm not trying to say I'm so great because I made that choice. It's a personal thing that happened to me. Probably every one of us has had to make a choice like that in our careers, didn't we? About maintaining our integrity or not. And sometimes the choices isn't all that, doesn't really matter all that much, but I bet you it still gnaws at you, doesn't it? You know, maybe it's not really leading to other people's harm, but when you go to bed at night, you're thinking about it. That's the problem. It leaves your mind. It might not necessarily lead to hurting other people, but it leaves our minds agitated. Why? Because we did the wrong thing. That's all. We did the wrong thing.
And the more you get into right speech and right action, the more you put your observation and your integrity into that, the clearer those choices become. And you can start drifting over in those directions. And sometimes you can do that within the job, and sometimes you can't. And it's time for, you know, start looking around.
And these are, you know, we're kind of getting to the heart of matter. These are the practical things that come up with a practical teaching. This isn't a teaching that allows us to get away with anything. Maybe that's the real problem. Mm-hmm. When we really get to the heart of the matter, what we're driven to live is a life of very high integrity. We don't have to do it right now. If we're still in a position where we're making a few compromises, That's part of the first noble truth that we're living in. But when we start developing the framework of the Eightfold Path, we're able to see it and make different choices. without the framework of the Eightfold Path, we're just going to continue doing that. And we might do it knowing that we're hurting ourselves and hurting other people, but we're making it okay. Because the fire is a passion of clouding our judgment. Because we're able to keep that the $3 million house going by cutting a few corners rather than downgrading to the $1 million house and living with integrity. You know, again, maybe that's even a little bit of a silly example. Mary, and I don't mean to put you on a spot. You seem like you're deep in thought about what. Is there something you'd like to talk about? Or, and again, please feel free to say, no, I don't feel like talking.
I don't feel like talking.
That's fine. Everything that the Buddha teaches is practically applied. And it's practically applied in all situations of our life. Now, remember I said, keep pointing to that. Different situations call up different parts of that 12-link chain of dependencies, depending on where we are. But the entire dependent origination, ignorance leading to suffering, is applicable across all of our situations. It's a circular practice. And again, that sounds a little esoteric and maybe mystical, but the practicality is, what are our choices right now? And getting back to what we've been talking about, or what I've been talking about for a few days, each moment holds the potential to turn our minds towards an awakening experience or to continue ignorance. And the practical example might come up in our career, it might come up in our relationship, it might come up in any area of our life, it might come up on our meditation cushions, it might come up right here in this room at this moment. What are we going to do with our minds? What are we going to do with our integrity? Meaning integrity, not even in a real moral sense, integrity in relation to the Eightfold Path. Are we going to hold on to that integrity? Are we going to be mindful, that refined mindfulness? Or are we going to say, it's just too much for me right now? Let me continue this way. And if you say, it's just too much for you right now, it's okay. Recognize the consequences of it. One of the difficulties, one of the problems of encountering this teaching is it's very hard, once you understand it, to say, I don't want to pay any attention to it. I'm going to make some compromises. I'm not going to live with all the integrity because it's going to gnaw at you now. You know, that really is the problem. It's hard to go back. It's hard to live an ordinary life once you've heard extraordinary things, you know, like we've heard this weekend. So I can kind of feel like everybody's maybe coming up to the true ramifications of what this teaching means, right? And it might seem a little scary or uncomfortable. It's just coming up against hardened views. You're coming up against a recognition of the real changes that thing requires. And it all leads to a life of lasting peace and happiness. Got to turn the flame out.
But I also find that every time you go past one of those hardened views, life does become easier.
It becomes incredibly. That's why the two processes. Say it again, please.
It may be difficult to be banging up against this hardened view or whatever the hardened view is that you're dealing with at that time, but once you're over it, there's a sense of ease right away. And all of a sudden, you're lighter.
Yeah, and
because you don't have to work at it anymore. Because every time you're working with the hardened view, it's hard work.
It is. And at the nexus of recognizing that is where the most confusion and emotional pain can be, because that's the hard choice. Do I continue with something I'm familiar with? Or remember, selfing, impermanence, dukkha, or liberation? That's the choice right there. When it comes up, when you're feeling it, when you're scared spitless, what's the choice going to be then? Choose liberation, because it might be painful, but if you choose the comfort of temporary dukkha, all you're doing is keeping those fires going. But if you choose the sometimes more painful way, you're moving towards liberation. And at some point, the use just continuing the metaphor, then the fires can't burn you anymore. They're difficult choices. Remember what the Buddha went through to get to this understanding. It almost physically killed him. It almost emotionally wiped him out. But he found a way between those extremes that makes the path a whole lot easier. Not completely easy. I often say it's a path of joy, ease and joy, but it's not for the faint of heart. There's times when we really gotta muscle up all we got and say, okay, I think this is the right thing to do. I think liberation is more important than dukkha. But because it's unfamiliar, because it's something at that point we've never done before, it takes that great leap, but it's not a leap of faith. We've taken refuge in the idea that a Buddha did, that a human being did this, he told us how to do it, and we have the support of each other in making those great leaps, which are really nothing at all. You know, it's a jump across no distance. Because what are we jumping across? We're jumping across something that is really non-existent, but it sure feels strong at times. It sure feels powerful. The drive at times to continue wandering in samsara is so strong. Again, if the Buddha realized this, if he thought I could just say, you know, you people, you're living in suffering of your own making, stop it. He could have done something else for 45 years. But he knew that that wasn't enough. He knew that we needed a way out of it. He knew that we needed an understanding, a very simple, but seemingly complicated at times understanding. But he also assured us by his own example. You know, he never elevated himself above humanity for that specific reason. He wanted to show everyone that was in front of him that if he could do it, they could do it. He's just another schmo like the rest of us. You know? There was nothing special about him. And he consistently said this: there's nothing special about me except I'm the Tathagata. I'm the one that did it first. You that awakened are the same as me as an arahant. I just did it first and I showed the way. He left us the way to do it. He left us the way through those really difficult times too, you know. Life is difficult. It's difficult whether we engage with the Dhamma or not. But if we engage with the Dhamma, we can get to the point where whatever is occurring in our life is met with equanimity. And it doesn't affect our lasting peace and happiness. We may be unpeaceful. I think I was saying to James earlier. Maybe not. I say this at class often. We can be at peace with less than peaceful mind states. Sounds pretty stupid at first, doesn't it? Isn't it a contradiction? But it simply means that when less than peaceful mind states, when we're involved in a situation that is agitating, we don't need it to be any different than it is. We're at peace with it. We're not fighting it. It's just what's occurring. When we have difficult decisions to make regarding, do I move forward this way or that way? We can make clear decisions because we don't need that agitated mind state to be any different than it is. We can be at peace with that. This is what's occurring. Things are troubling right now. That's what's occurring. With the refined mindfulness that's developed, we can see where that agitation, where that troublesome mind state is arising from. And make a more mindful decision. That's why we need concentration. So we can see that. So we can hold our focus on what's most important, the framework of the Eightfold Path, rather than reacting and making us make decisions based on a self-referential ego self, rather than mindful awareness of who we truly are. Practical. So, any questions? Any comments? I think the gravity of these teachings is settling into this room. And I think I'll leave it at that. We'll meditate, and then we're going to have, for want of a better word, a mindful social tonight, which means we can let our hair down a little bit, lighten up about this. The last thing I'll say is we can't take any of this too personally, because none of it is personal.
No.
None of it is personal. But then again, it's the most personal thing we'll ever engage with, ourselves. So, yes, why don't we stretch? In fact, if Matt, you want to do a little something before we sit? Mary, I'm just asking, if you want to talk, please feel free. If you don't, it's okay too. Pardon me? As soon as we're done here tonight, okay? You have incredible courage to come and face all this. It really is amazing. And it is. That's why. You're at a nexus point. This may be one of the most difficult times. We'll talk about this more. But you're putting yourself in a position to develop lasting peace and happiness by facing some of the toughest things you'll ever face. But it's all impermanent. You're coming up against fabrications. Nothing that's real.
Yep.
But you need it, maybe in a physical sense, but in a metaphorical sense, you need someone to hold your hand. That's what this is about. We'll talk after. Thank you. Thank you, Matt. Would you like to join us? We're going to sit for a half hour. You're more than welcome. So just to put a fine point on what we've been talking about, this is the end of the booklet. It's not the end of our retreat, though. As clinging subsides and passion or craving for sensory input ceases, The links of the 12-link chain of dependencies unbind. There is no ignorance remaining to sustain confusion, delusion, and further suffering. There is nothing to fuel further karmic entanglements and nothing to give birth to another unsatisfactory experience. Peace and happiness prevail. So let's enter our meditation on that note. Welcome, sir. I'm so glad you could join us.
I was driving by.
Thank you for joining us.
We're visiting a group here.
Nice to have you.
We've been here for a few days.
Not in this room.
So, find your relaxed meditative posture. And gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. Excuse me. Just get a feel for what that's like. To be mindful of your breath and your body. And while remaining mindful of your breath and your body, notice that thoughts are flowing. We're conscious beings. Thoughts should be flowing. The purpose of Shamatha Vipassana meditation is to not be distracted by our own thoughts. So when you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. I'll repeat that. When you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. And we'll meditate for 30 minutes.
putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. Take a moment to notice the quality of your mind. Be at peace with your mind.